2014 Claims Committee Subcommittee, Joint House and Senate Subcommittee, will come to order. First item on the agenda is the April 16 minutes. But since we don't have, we'll hold on those. And the first claim on the agenda is a claim against the Department of Transportation. Mr. Coney here. And Corey Zian, Representative Ward.
Yes, I'm representing.
Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Corey Zian is the Corey Zian claim is against the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and as I understand it, Mr. Zian and a number of other people work for a contractor by the name of M.G. Carlson Company Inc. on a MnDOT project that involved renovation of the Staples train depot roof. And the work, I believe, was performed between June and December of 2009. And then, according to the record here, the Department of Transportation did an audit on November 10th of 2010, which showed that Mr. Zian and seven other individuals had not been paid the prevailing wage. And Mr. Zion's claim is around $5,700, and that was the he was the one who was underpaid the most of these total of eight individuals. So Mr. Zian is requesting that he be paid at least part of his claim out of the retainage, the contract retainage. The department has opposed that payment and cited the payment bond scheme in the statutes for getting paid for contract work. And those statutes say that you have to make a claim on the payment bond within 120 days after the last item of work is done. So you can see from the record that MnDOT made a number of attempts to find this Mr. Carlson and get him to pay the individuals who were underpaid on the contract, and recently made an attempt to work through the performance bond carrier for the contractor by the name of Granite Re. To pay the individuals on a prorated basis from the contract retainage. So I think that summarizes the case, and perhaps we can go to the testimony.
Mr. Coney.
Madam Chair, my name is Jim Coney, and I'm with MnDOT, where I'm the Assistant Chief Counsel. Your counsel provided a pretty good summary of the case. This construction started in May of 2009 and actually went into 2010 because it was kind of a messed up project for a variety of reasons. We had a number of problems with the contractor, including the underpayment of wages, primarily through misclassifying people and failing to pay people the correct amount of overtime, primarily. Now, MnDOT puts a lot of effort into having contractors settle these wage disputes. We pursue them aggressively. We have pursued M.G. Carlson aggressively for a number of years. We've gone after M.G. Carlson. We've done audits and directed them the amount underpaid to each employee and directed them to pay these employees. We've reached out to Carlson on numerous occasions. We even reached out in an attempt to settle the matter with Carlson. When those failed, we went to Carlson's performance bond company and attempted to get them to honor the claim, and they refused to honor the claim under the performance bond, and they say that the claims under the payment bond were already stale, so they wouldn't honor them under the payment bond either. So MnDOT has made a number of aggressive attempts to get this company to pay these workers. There's no doubt that the claimant's situation is unfortunate. There's also no doubt that this situation was created by M.G. Carlson. MnDOT didn't take any actions to prevent Mr. Zion or others to keep from asserting their legal rights against M.G. Carlson or against the provider of the payment bonds. So there's simply been no act or omission by MnDOT which led to the claimant's loss. We certainly empathize with the claimant's plight. We're here mainly because we're concerned that the that there could be a bad precedent set by honoring this claim here. We would hate for contractors to kind of abandon their claims, in essence decide that it's cheaper and easier for them to not resolve these claims and just kind of throw them over here to the Legislative Claims Committee and ask the members of this committee to resolve these problems. So we think there's a, number one, there wasn't an act or omission by MnDOT that led to this harm, and number two, we think there's just a bad precedent that could be set by honoring this claim. Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Well, Mr. Coney, what about the bad precedent of the workers not getting paid their proper due?
Madam Chair, MnDOT certainly empathizes with the plight of the workers in this case. As I said, we have a staff, a fairly sizable staff, that's devoted to pursuing these wage issues and enforcing the prevailing wage laws. And in the overwhelming majority of cases, we get contractors to pay up. Sometimes they delay because there's no real penalty for delay, but in most cases, we do get these claims resolved.
Is Ms. Chair?
Senator?
Is there enough retainage that's available to pay this claim if we were to require that be the disposition of this case?
Madam Chair, Senators, the total amount of unpaid wages is about $14,000. There's about $10,000 roughly in retainage on this contract at this point, and we have I have talked with Ms. Timmons about a potential prorating scheme where the prorated amount of each claimant's wages could be paid, that $10,000 retainage.
The retainage, what do you mean by retainage? How much money is left over at DOT?
Yes, Madam Chair. Normally, MnDOT holds an amount of retainage on a contract, and that's kind of to motivate the contractor to do all of the things they're supposed to do. And in this case, we held a fairly sizable chunk towards the end of the project, $10,000, as leverage to try and get M.G. Carlson to resolve these wage complaints. M.G. Carlson is no longer functioning in Minnesota. My understanding is that they are now working in Texas, and M.G. Carlson is basically no longer responsive to either MnDOT or the Department of Administration.
Ms. Timmons, is Corey Zian the only person that's asking for money, or are all of them asking for money?
To my knowledge, he's the only one. Mr. Zion is the only one who has filed a claim. If you look, though, on page 28 of 32, back a few pages there from my recommendation on this claim, you will see up at the top of that page where there is a listing of the eight individuals who were underpaid and the prorated amount. If you use that $10,961.02 that has been retained to pay each one of them on a prorated basis.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Let me just talk about some of the things that Mr. Coney said, and I so much appreciate the opportunity to represent Mr. Zion here. He is one of my constituents. Madam Chair, And members, this has been going on, as Ms. Timmons and others, Mr. Coney and others have suggested, since 2009. As a matter of fact, members, Mr. Zion communicated with Roxanne in the construction MnDOT office about way back at the beginning of this, and communicated with her. And I don't have Roxanne's last name, but I do. I can get her contact information because Mr. Zion has that still.
Wilder.
Thank you, Wilder. Okay, so he communicated with Ms. Wilder in the construction office about pursuing fair and just payment with a shortage of $5,700. I think Mr. Coney said it was $5,700. Ms. Timmons said $5,700. And Ms. Wilder had repeatedly said that this is an ongoing process. This is an ongoing process. This is an ongoing process. To Ms. Timmons, 120 days. He has done that within the 120 days, but he's always been told this is an ongoing process. This is an ongoing process. This is an ongoing process. And this has been going on for years with MnDOT. And he has some validation. I myself, Madam Chair, members, have sent MnDOT a number of letters on this issue back from 2013 on when Mr. Zion made me familiar with the issue initially. And Ms. Timmons and Mr. Coney talked about a retainage fee of $10,900-some-odd. I have a letter from Commissioner Zelli. Commissioner Zelli, I'm assuming we all know, is the Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Transportation, who says there is a retainage of $19,868.45, dated June 21st, 2013. So I don't know now why there is all of a sudden, as I have heard, nobody has been paid out. Nobody has made a claim except Mr. Zion. Why from June 21st, 2013, where Commissioner Zelli has said there was $19,868.45, that we are now down to $10,900. These are wages as financial obligations withheld by MnDOT to Mr. Carlson because he did not fulfill the obligations. And, there's a $9,000 differential there, and I think that Ms. Timmons or Mr. Coney said that there were about seven people that had a Senator Scalzi asked how much is there left in there, and there's seven people that I thought had about a total of $14,000 obligation to be met, which the $19,000 would cover that, obviously, all those folks that have been, in my opinion, wronged by a contractor who is now no longer doing business in the state of Minnesota, and rightfully so, because he did not live up to our obligations. So, Madam Chair, I would ask the subcommittee on claims to act favorably on Mr. Zion's request. As a matter of fact, the MnDOT themselves, MnDOT didn't do anything wrong here. It was Mr. Carlson, but to say to Mr. Zion, find this guy and sue him, MnDOT couldn't find this guy. You guys had a hard time finding this guy, and until you found out he left the state. And so, how is my constituent, Madam Chair, members, supposed to find this guy when MnDOT a single person couldn't find this guy? They had a whole agency to find him, and they couldn't find him. So, again, we try to do things that are right down here. We all try to do that, and this is the right thing to do, is to cover lost wages that this gentleman earned. I know also, Madam Chair, members, there was an attorney general was looking into this as well. And I don't know if the attorney general has come back with I never received any kind of advice from the attorney general's office, but I'm... They were notified of the wrongdoings here, but I have not heard if they weighed in, and I don't know if MnDOT has heard anything on that. So I would hope that the subcommittee on claims would act favorably on this, and I'll be happy to answer any questions I might have. I just talked to Mr. Zion this afternoon, Madam Chair, and one of his questions is, and members, I'd ask you the same thing. There's $19,000 of retainage here that Commissioner Zelli talked about. If we don't pay back those earnings that were rightfully owed to the workers, as Madam Chair so rightfully asked Mr. Coney. Where does that money go? Where does that almost $20,000 go? And you know, that was one of Mr. Zion's questions, and Representative Ward's questions too. So I think, Madam Chair, I would just leave it at that, and be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Coney, is the number $19,868.45, or is it the $10,000?
Madam Chair, I spent quite a bit of time digging into that $19,000 number that's referenced in Commissioner Zelli's letter. And from all of the documents I reviewed, I concluded that that was an unfortunate error in Commissioner Zelli's letter. I believe it was a misinterpretation of kind of the last pay request we received from M.G. Carlson. I think that's how much M.G. Carlson believed they were owed on the contract. But all of the documents that I have reviewed, Madam Chair, show about $10,000 in retainage.
Mr. Coney, did the workers got paid, but they did not get prevailing wages, right? What kind of wages did they receive?
Madam Chair, that's kind of the heart of the matter in this case. Most of the workers got paid something. For example, a lot of the issue was they were classified as roofers versus they should have gotten a higher wage rate as carpenters. I think there were issues with overtime not being paid at the proper rate or on enough hours as well. Those were kind of the two key findings in this case. As Representative Ward indicated, we've certainly gone round and round with M.G. Carlson, and we, at our urging, the Department of Administration has suspended them as a state vendor, and we believe they will soon be debarred, which is kind of a moral victory since we don't anticipate Mr. Carlson will be back in Minnesota anytime soon. But
where is he, Mr. Coney?
Madam Chair, he is working in Texas. Apparently, they don't have any laws about paying people.
Or prevailing wages down there either, probably. But do you say there is $10,000-something?
Madam Chair, we believe the $10,000 number that Ms. Timmons has put forward is the correct number.
And then... So what if we were to deny this, where would the $10,000 number go?
Madam Chair, at some point, MnDOT would have to decide to kind of close the file on this project. We would de-encumber those funds, and those funds would cancel back to whichever fund they originated from.
And which fund do they originate from?
Madam Chair, I don't have that information in front of me, but I can certainly find that out and get back to you. I believe it would not have come from the Trump Highway Fund. It would have come from the General Fund or some other appropriation.
Representative Ward, is the Staples Depot, was it fixed and is it leaking?
Madam Chair, as far as I know, I've been through Staples is out of my district, but I've been through there a number of times, and the depot is fixed. It looks beautiful. I don't believe there's any problems with it anymore, from my knowledge. So I think the project itself has been completed. The only unfortunate thing is the workers haven't been completed. And you might want to, Mr. Coney, you might want to hang on to that, because I've got a bill that's going to probably be flying here to allow folks to recover some losses if this ever happens again. It's just the right thing to do, so,
in
my opinion.
Mr. Coney, when you know a company like M.G. Carlson Construction Company has left the state and they're debarred, so to speak, or de-roofed or de-something, decommissioned, and they are operating in another state, then do you follow up to that other state and tell them they were bad and that they're not reliable? Does Minnesota do that?
Madam Chair, we have not done that to the best of my knowledge.
Representative Ward, maybe we should all, the Claims Commission, should go to Texas.
Madam Chair, I think
with signs.
I'm available.
we're available for a few days in a
few weeks, Madam
in
Chair.
A couple weeks. Yeah, we could. Want to come?
I think my wife has other plans.
Oh, all right. Sally and John and I could go.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Johnson.
I'm just wondering if either one of you know if the any of these gentlemen have tried to go after through the courts through the bonding company instead of just saying no, going taking them to court and saying, well, they held a bond, they did what they're supposed to do, but the bond company's not doing what they're supposed to do, holding up their end of the bargain.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. County.
Representative Johnson, I believe that has happened. However, these folks face a significant hurdle when they go after the bonding company, and that is that they only have 120 days from the date they last provided labor to the project. They have 120 days to pursue that claim, and that is by statute. So often when these folks realize they've been underpaid or the claim has passed, or they don't want to rock the boat while they're working, so they wait until the seasonal layoff happens or something like that, and their claim is stale at that point.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Ward.
To that point, Representative Johnson, thank you for asking that question, because Representative Zion, Mr. Zion, and I don't know about the others, but Mr. Zion, you know, was looking at other possibilities of what he could do, but he was working with the MnDOT staff to try to correct the matter within the MnDOT process. And the MnDOT process kept stringing him out and stringing him out and stringing him out and stringing him out. And I'm not necessarily blaming anybody, but, you know, now let's correct that. We understand now what the whole deal, how it happened. And so now let's correct that.
Representative Johnson.
Believe me, I understand that. When they do those audits, it's usually not within 120 days after the project's done.
Right.
So it's something maybe we can look at through for next year through legislation to lengthen that time period after an audit period is done. Give time to work it out. But I've also been on the end of it and received the paycheck in the mail a year and a half after I worked for a company on a project. So I know that generally the contractors do the right thing. It's just the unfortunate bad ones that create headaches for everybody. So,
any further question? What is your recommendation, Council?
Well, Madam Chair and members, I guess it really depends on the policy judgment call that the subcommittee members wish to make. I mean, I can't see actually appropriating funds to pay this. That would certainly open a Pandora's box. So it seems like there are only two viable alternatives, either one to deny the claim or to authorize the department to make payment to Mr. Zion out of the contract retainage. And then I guess there's a subset policy issue there if the subcommittee chose that latter door, whether you wish to pay everybody who was underpaid on a pro-rata basis or pay Mr. Zion at the full rate because he's the one who has brought the claim. I don't know. And, Madam Chair, because paying out of the contract retainage was a little bit complicated, I did take the liberty of drafting some possible language that would effectuate paying out of the retainage and paying the eight individuals on a pro rata basis. And I know we don't have a quorum here to take a vote, but perhaps subcommittee members could look at that language, or if you'd like me to walk through it, I'd be happy to do that.
Mr. Coney, do you know if all these people are still living?
I do not know, Madam Chair. We would certainly, if the committee directs us to pay these folks, we will certainly do our best to track them down. If we can't track them down, presumably we could give money through the Department of Commerce unclaimed property provisions. But our regular compliance unit should have files on all of these people, so we believe we should be able to contact them.
Mr. Chair? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just kind of curious if we know that Mr. Zayn has filed a claim. To your knowledge, have any of the other people at least contacted MnDOT and said, hey, I think you owe me money, other than filing a claim?
Mr. Coney.
Madam Chair, Senator, unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that question, but I believe our labor compliance unit would have notified all of these people that they have been underpaid. That's kind of their standard operating process. I asked, to an earlier point, I asked our labor compliance folks, you know, what for statistics on, you know, how often they run into these cases, and they told me almost all of the contractors settle. Some of them delay, but they almost all settle. They thought anecdotally this is probably about 1% of our contracts. But, you know, as I said, we certainly would do our best to track these folks down if that's what the committee wishes us to do.
Ms. Timmons, what if Corey Zan was to receive the full amount that was due to him, what would that be?
Madam Chair and members, I believe, and Mr. Coney could correct me if I'm wrong, the most recent running of that total, I believe, is on page 24 of 32 of your documentation, and I believe it's $5,769.80.
Ms. Timmons, we're going to have to talk about this after when we get more another senator. But I think that because Mr. Zion filed the claim, he should receive that much, if anybody's going to receive something. And then if you want to prorate the rest of the money for the others, that could be a consideration.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson, what do you think?
This could be a tough decision because this could open up Pandora's box for none of the contractors to pay these claims out. We're dealing with less than 1%. Mr. Zinn deserves his money as long as the other seven members. They deserve their money that's due them. But it can be a Pandora's box where if we open this up just on this case, it could open it up. So instead of having just 1% of the contractors not fulfilling their duties, we could end up with 75-80% that's going to be coming here that we're going to be dealing with it all the time, too. I'm not sure what's going to be the proper way to handle this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, I guess my perspective, Representative Johnson, is that we're pretty fortunate in Minnesota that we have only 1% of the contractors that are like this. And so this, you know, in my opinion, this is a fair process. This is what the process is about right now. It's a fair process. It's a process that, as Madam Chair has suggested, Mr. Zion has followed. I don't know if the other one, Representative Senator Scalzi, has asked a question if, you know, other of those that have been wronged have also filed a complaint. We don't know that. But we do know that Mr. Zion, my constituent, has filed a complaint, and it's the process. And I don't think, in my opinion, you know, we have this process in place that has worked well, that less than 1% of the contractors are not following what they need to be doing. And so, in my opinion, we're not opening up Pandora's box. We are doing what is right
to those folks that have been wronged by a contractor, sure, but here's what the process has said to Mr. Zion and to seven other people. Follow this process. So I'm bringing this forward on behalf of Mr. Zion as part of the process.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, I understand as well that this is part of the process. It's that I'm just concerned that it might open up Pandora's box, and I got to look down the road what might happen on the road of unintended consequences. Should all these eight people be paid what they're due? Absolutely, they should have been. But how to do this the right way without having unintended consequences? Unintended consequences is the issue. But I think you can agree with me on that as well.
Well, I'm sure.
Representative Ward.
And I understand that. And I have had bills, legislation. We all have had legislation that have unintended consequences, certainly. But, the other thing that I consider, Representative Johnson, is there is $10,000 to $20,000 that is rightfully to the workers on that project. And if those workers don't recover the due that's owed them, we are going to get that.
Yep.
We'll spend it, won't we? We'll spend it. And I think that's wrong. I think that we should do what's right by them.
Do we get it, or does DOT, Representative Ward?
Well, Madam Chair, I heard from Mr. Coney that it's probably going to go back to general fund. Is what I heard. And so if it goes back to general fund, Madam Chair, we, the reps of the bodies, will truly take that $20,000 and find some place to go for it with it.
Mr. Coney, that money doesn't stay within the... Does that money stay within DOT, or does it go back to the general fund?
Madam Chair, I'm certainly not an expert on the state's financial system, but I'll tell you what I believe to be the case here. This money was from a previous year appropriation, and I don't believe that it came out of the Trunk Highway Fund. So when MnDOT de-encumbers this money, it will cancel back to whatever fund it originated from. And since it was a previous year appropriation, I think it will be out of MnDOT's hands at that point.
I can answer that one.
Representative Johnson.
It'll go back to the taxpayers. It's the taxpayers' money. It's not our money. No. It's the taxpayers' money.
And so is Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Madam Chair.
Well, Director Commissioner Zelli was talking about that money. But by MnDOT for the stables work. So it started with MnDOT. So the money was first appropriated to MnDOT. How did it leave MnDOT's hands?
Madam Chairman, money gets appropriated to MnDOT in a couple of ways. First, it can be for a specific building, often through a bonding bill. Otherwise, MnDOT gets a pot of money for relatively small projects that MnDOT awards contracts for. So I'm assuming that this re-roofing projects was part of that second category where it just came from a pot of money appropriated to MnDOT to do minor building work.
Actually, Madam Chair,
Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, didn't this money come from the contractor in the form of a bond? And so it didn't come from the taxpayers. It was from the contractor. It's not the taxpayers' money. It's the contractor, which in turn should be the employee's money.
And then he left it behind for MnDOT to disperse to Mr. Zion or Mr. Zion and all those others.
Madam Chair, the roughly $10,000 remaining let's say the contractor earned it, for lack of a better term here, and had the contractor written checks to these employees as we had directed him to do, we would have paid out the balance of this contract to the contractor. We have not received any money from the contractor in surety or anything like this. So this is the state's money that we held on to as leverage in an attempt to get MG Carlson to resolve these wage problems.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you,
Mr. Cowaney.
Madam Chair, if I may just ask, how do we find out the resolution?
You wait till Mr. Carlson comes, or
Mr. Osmond
comes. Or Mr. Osmond comes, and then we'll explain. Senator Scalzi will explain how with him. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson and I'll talk together, and Representative Simon is supposed to come, and we'll clue him in, and then I'll make a motion. Or Mr. Johnson can make a motion, or Senator Scalzi can make a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
But right now we can't make motions because, oops, we don't have a quorum. We need two people on either side for quorum.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll talk to you. So we'll go. But we got all the information we need.
We do.
Sort of.
Thank you.
But we can't take it this long on, oh my gosh.
We'll be here till midnight.
Thank goodness the rules say that we can't be here past midnight. In my day, I've been known to pass midnight, but not on the claims committee. I've never done it.
Let's not be the first.
Second item on the agenda is claims against the Department of Revenue. Lisa and Greg Story. Who's from Revenue?
Mr. Finnegan.
Mr. Finnegan?
Yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair, subcommittee members, my name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney in the Minnesota Revenue Department. And we put an answer in on this claim. I can briefly summarize it if you want me to.
Sure.
The claim is an estimated amount of $653, which allegedly represents a 2011 Minnesota property tax refund claim. The Department of Revenue has no record of ever receiving a 2011 property tax refund claim from Mr. and Mrs. Story. Minnesota Statute Section 28940 sub 4 states that a property tax refund claim is not allowed if the initial claim is filed more than 1 year after the original date for filing the claim. And the original due date for filing of a 2011 property tax refund was August 15, 2012, which means that under the statute, no refund is allowed if the original claim was filed after August 15, 2013. The department, it's our position that we don't have the authority under law to issue a refund in this situation to the claimant. We never received a claim, so we never acted on it. And even if we had now, it would be filed late. And based on the information that we have, it would appear that even if it had been filed timely, that we wouldn't have qualified for the refund.
Well, then why are they going to the trouble to file a claim?
Madam Chair, my opinion, I've never talked to them, but my opinion is that they filed a claim for their 2012 property tax refund and at that time realized that they had not filed a 2011 property tax refund claim, and that the time for filing it had already expired, so they filed a claim with the subcommittee.
Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, perhaps what I could add, I think Mr. Finnegan correctly summarized the claim by the taxpayers here, that they just didn't have sufficient notice of the time for filing the claim and that the property tax form wasn't sufficiently clear. In the past, The Subcommittee on Claims has been, I think, somewhat reluctant to waive these timelines because of the policy issues involved. I do remember a couple of cases in which the subcommittee did waive the timelines, one where the taxpayer came and she really explained about serious illness that she suffered during the time that the refund documents would have been due, and the subcommittee decided in that very rare instance to allow the relief. And then there was another claim where the person had made the refund and put it into a mailbox, and there was actually a news report that the mailboxes had been vandalized and there had been a theft out of the mailbox. So the subcommittee felt there was sufficient proof that the taxpayer had in good faith tried to make the claim for the refund. And those are the only two cases I can recall. I don't believe Mr. and Mrs. Story are here. And I know that we did, claims committee staff did notify them of the hearing tonight.
Madam Chair, just to give you a little broader information.
Mr. Finnegan.
Each year, the Department of Revenue denies a large number of property tax refund claims because they're filed past the statute of limitations, past the time they're due. So, in a sense, it's a fairness issue for us that we don't have the authority to issue a refund here, but we try to treat all taxpayers equally. So if we're denying claims because they're filed untimely, we try to be consistent in that approach.
And then, and so Ms. Timmons, you're saying that they were notified and they could have...
Well, I believe they were notified of the, Madam Chair and members, I believe they were notified of the Claims Committee meeting tonight, and, you know, so that they could have been able to testify as to an extreme hardship or something like that that might have convinced the Subcommittee on Claims that they had a good reason not to file, as opposed to the vast majority of all the other property taxpayers who've had to follow the rules, and they're apparently not here tonight.
Madam Chair.
And Representative Norton isn't here either.
I was going to say also that when we filed our answer with the subcommittee, we did copy Mr. and Mrs. Story, you know, sent them a copy of the answer and that we filed. We never received any response from them.
But they sent their filing fee in September of 13. And this was not considered by the 2013 claims.
No, Madam Chair, it was not.
Okay. Right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you. I think what Representative Johnson had said during the last deliberations was that this could open up a Pandora's box. And the letter from the claimants states fairly clearly that they did not look on their property tax statement to know that they could file for a refund. So this is the kind of thing that I think would be hazardous for us to do, since the other ones that were paid had some very extenuating circumstances. That would be my opinion. I know we can't make a motion. If we could, I would.
Sure. Keep that in mind. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Claims against the Department of Human Services. Who is here from Department of Human Services? Holy cow, you've got almost an inch. There's five things, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Proctor, yes. Would you prefer to go first, or Ms. Timmons?
Ms. Timmons?
Ms. Timmons?
Madam Chair and members, these claims against the Department of Human Services are all property claims, and these are all ones on which I have recommended denial. So one, we certainly can go through them one by one, or if the subcommittee wanted to, once we have a quorum, treat them as a block like we do the property claims from the Department of Corrections. You could certainly do that. Or if obviously, if any member has a question about one of the claims, we can take any that have questions.
Okay. Is anyone here on behalf of any of the five complainants? Is that the right word?
I feel like court, right?
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
No, okay, so it's just us. Okay, Ms. Proctor.
I don't have anything to add other than what I've submitted. If you have questions, I'm certainly available to answer those questions.
Representative Johnson.
This first one on Mr. Lentz.
Mm-hmm.
I had the same type of equipment at my house. It did the exact same thing. There's an atomic battery in them at a certain time. Once it goes, the equipment no longer works. There's no indication it just quits working.
Really?
I learned that the hard way. So I had to go buy a PlayStation 3 for my son.
Oh.
They don't last.
Well, that's a bummer.
Okay. There we have a quorum.
All right. Sarah Carlson?
Yes.
We're on number 5, and we're thinking of taking these as a pile or as an inch. And Ms. Timmons has recommended denial, and there's nobody here, and Representative Johnson has given this testimony to say that denial is right.
All of those sections.
Mm-hmm. And his atomic battery went dead for his little kid, so he had to buy a new station, PlayStation.
You never know what life experience is.
Senator Scalzi?
Yes, well, were you looking for a motion, Ms. Chair? Ms. Chair, I would move that we deny the claims against the Department of Human Services for Lenz, Pittman, Pyron, and Pyron.
Any further discussion? I bet that wasn't an atomic battery. Although I don't know. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Number 6. Injury claims against under $500 for the Department of Corrections. Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, item 6 is the reimbursement for the injury claims under $500 that the Department of Corrections has paid in advance. And I believe that is the most recent amount is in the packet of extra materials that were at your desk. And the current total amount for that is $2,359.82. Typically that amount is paid and put in the claims bill.
And is it your recommendation that we...
Yes, it is, Madam
pass
Chair.
Pass that, then?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
since that's our, my understanding, it's already been paid out. Just needs our approval to be paid. For the record, is that correct?
Correct.
Correct.
So I'll make that motion.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. $2,359.82 is approved.
Yes.
Oh, for good. Good. For good.
Cheryl, would you like to take the first that do have people where they are in the audience?
I think that would be polite.
Claims. Okay. Well, then I think perhaps we should take the Gary Green case first.
Okay. Number two. Number three.
Yeah, it's actually Gary number Green. Three in your book.
Mr. Green?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, ma'am. Thank you for asking. I'm Peter Nikitas. I'm an attorney in St. Paul and Minneapolis, and I'm appearing in the place of Mr. Green's incumbent attorney, Mr. Jordan Kushner. And Mr. Green appears to my right and to the chair's left, and we're here on in the matter of his claim against the Department of Corrections. Correspondence relating to the matter is dated December 23rd, 2013, from Mr. Hartnett on the matter. Mr. Green comes before the Claims Committee to seek approval of his claim of $7,400 in connection with his work on a sentence to service crew in Hennepin County in 2010. And his sentence to service crew at the time was performing the work of removing boulders with a bobcat, and a malfunction ensued, and Mr. Green suffered significant injuries to his right arm and his right hand, and he underwent examination by department individuals and physicians hired for this specific purpose, or staff physicians for this purpose. They examined his injuries and correlated it to the state's workers' comp tables, finding his injuries to satisfy the criteria of 9.25% permanent disability, and multiplying that percentage by the maximum allowed of $80,000, the department is recommending $7,400 and no cents. Madam Chair, we do have four photographs for the committee's benefit to underscore the significance and to put some flesh and bones and skin upon the this claim, if it would please the chair and the committee. And I notice my colleague, Mr. Hartnett, is here to...
Yes, and Ms. Timmons is here to guide us also.
Yes.
Yes, Ms. Timmons. Madam Chair and members, you may recall that this claim was actually in front of the 2013 Claims Committee, Subcommittee on Claims. But at that time, there was not a medical evaluation, and so it was unclear as to what the extent of permanency was. And since that time, I understand there has been medical evaluation, and Mr. Hartnett has recommended the $7,400, and I'm in agreement with that.
Okay. Mr. Green?
Yes.
Are you in agreement with it?
Yes, I am. Okay.
Mr. Hartnett, do you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, I do. When Mr. Green's case came before the subcommittee last time, he was in kind of an enviable position compared to many of our claimants in that his medical insurance had covered all of his medical bills. And as you know, the statute makes an individual's medical insurance primary. He had, we had received a very opinion from Dr. Sue Tuttle, who was his treating physician, that she did not believe Mr. Green had any permanency. However, at the meeting last year, we agreed to allow him to be evaluated at the Health Partners by an employment specialist, and that is the basis for the rating that we have before the subcommittee today.
Okay. Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, Mr. Green informs me that he has additional documentation to supplement the considerations of the committee. With that in mind, we are standing on the claim for $7,400 as set forth in the December 23rd letter of Mr. Hartnett with the enclosures that do include that do embrace the Health Partners examination and evaluation of which Mr. Hartner just addressed the committee.
Senator.
You know, I have a question, Ms. Chair. I'm wondering...
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I'm wondering because I'm sort of confused. There's... a report here from April 1st of 2013, which states not to pay the claim. And so is that, what has changed since April of 2013, Ms. Timmons? I'm wondering, what has changed other than the health insurance not being exempt?
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, what has changed is that there has been an additional medical evaluation at Health Partners, as Mr. Hartnett explained. So really there was a second opinion and a more in-depth evaluation as to potential permanency, and now the department and the claimant and I, as your legal counsel, we are all satisfied that the $7,400 figure is correct for permanency. Okay.
Senator?
I remember when we discussed this, we thought that it should be examined.
Motion?
I'll move to, I guess I don't have the number right.
$7,400.
And move to make that settlement.
Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, thank you very much on behalf of Mr. Kushner and Mr. Green.
You're
thank
welcome.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Timmons?
Madam Chair and members, I believe the attorney for James Vandevender, item 12, is here, and perhaps we should take that one out of order next as a courtesy.
We're going to... Tab 12, blue. Mr.
Do you
Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair, I'll start on this one. I think that this is one that actually is somewhat similar to the Gary Green case, in a similar posture to what the Gary Green case was last year, in that we've received the claim. And this is a claim with a date of injury of June 8th of 2012. And essentially, Mr. Vandervender was at work at Rush City in their printing operation when another offender hit him repeatedly with a board and caused some head injuries. And so I think that Mr. Hartnett's recommendation is that we not resolve the case tonight, but that we give it some time for fleshing out what permanency there might be. And I understand there's also a potential wage loss claim, which would need much more documentation. But I thought we put it on the agenda because, number one, it is a pretty serious injury. And I thought the subcommittee would want to know about it. And secondly, Mr. Hartnett has included in your documentation the case of Kenneth Champagne Davis versus the state of Minnesota, which is a court of appeals case decided in 1993 that had somewhat similar facts, in that another offender attacked Mr. Kenneth Champagne Davis at work in a prison. And the Court of Appeals held that the claims subcommittee on claims process was the exclusive remedy for Mr. Davis in pursuing his claim. And then the Minnesota Supreme Court did not take review of the case. So this case stands as good law. So with that, I don't know if there's more testimony, brief testimony, about the procedural posture that we're in here with this case.
Mr. Hartnett. Mr. Van Den.
I'm Keith Hanratty.
Oh.
I represent Mr. Van Den.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for having me, Madam
Chair. Keith Penderit.
Just a brief overview. I'm from Excelsior now. My family's been here for about 100 years, so good job on the commons, by the way. Thank you.
Money's not there yet, sir. Money's not there yet.
Yeah, I want to, you know, I don't, and I looked at that case you're mentioning, and my philosophy is that why would you not come here, given the philosophy that this is non-adversarial? We have an enlightened legislature that knows. Now, you lose your pain and suffering, but, you know, there's other considerations, and we're fair people. We're Minnesotans, and we're basically nice, and we're humane. And this is the only place James Vandervender can come for, you know, to redress his horrible injury. And what happened is it took him about an hour to get him out of the prison and get him in an ambulance. And then after the guy whacked him over the head six times with a 2x4.
Why?
No one knows. It's just he didn't like him. He's a lifer, and he wasn't segregated, basically came in and he just didn't like my guy, and that was it. And he was sitting in a tail, came up, took a few practice swings and brought in his 2x4 and whacked him six times. I'm making light of it, but it's so sad and it's so serious that this is the only place to go under Minnesota law. It's right here. And in its wisdom, the legislature has put you here the way this man's, basically his future, is in your hands. I've been a trial lawyer for 20 years doing personal injury claims, 25 years. And if you take this the way it's supposed to be, and you present the claim, and you have an exceptionally good counsel here, he's very knowledgeable, and he knows what he's doing, and he's fair, and you're all fair, and I trust the process. I'm not going to pad anything. You're going to see exactly what goes on in the doctor's mind. I have a permanency report that's due because we don't know how extensively he's injured. He's tired. He works as a barrel hoop maker. He makes about $13 an hour, but he's really tired at the end of the day, and he's having a hard time. He can't form words so well. But he's doing the best he can. He's made a remarkably good recovery. He's doing the best he can, but he's basically brain damaged. So you look at a person's entire life, work history, because he's going to work, you know, I'm going to make a claim on that basis. His whole life ahead of him, because we can only come here once. Only, this is it, one time, no place else. This is it. And if I come in here and I'm going to present a claim, we're going to debate it. If you lose your ability to make a living because you're brain damaged, and we're not going to go into fault. We're not going to blame anyone here. That's not what this is about. I'm not going to blame the state of Minnesota. We're past that point. We're only looking under the enlightened legislature. There is no blame here. There's no, you know, but it's like we're going to ask you for a significant amount of money, and I'm going to show you why. And I hope you'll agree with me. And I think Mr. Hartnett and I will work this out before we come back again and see you. And perhaps, it's a lot of money we're going to be asking for, but then you can look at it another way. If, let's say, we don't award any money, or there's not enough, well, then it comes out another way. Well, he won't do so well. He won't be able to live anywhere. He'll go on assisted living. Right now he's living with his mother. Okay, mom's taking care of him. So hopefully we can work something out. We will show the injury. We'll show the damages. And I'll present it again. And I want to thank everyone for their courtesy. And I won't belabor the point, but I do think this is when you get these claims, if I went in another venue, it'd be millions and millions of dollars. But, the legislature has protected itself. Protected the state of Minnesota because you don't collect for pain and suffering, not a dime. So we're not going to ask for any of that. And we're not going to pad the claim. We're just going to have you consider it, have a discussion, and I'll ask you for a substantial award. And I'll turn this over to an enlightened counsel here.
Mr. Hartnett.
Madam Chair, to expand on counsel's statements here, we have had, fortunately, as some of you are aware, I've been before this committee for approximately 20 years off and on. Fortunately, we haven't had a large number of claims where an individual was injured while performing assigned duty or injured while performing a sentence to serve work, where the result of that injury was because of aggressive action on the part of another individual that was also working there. This is, as Mr. Hanratty pointed out, not a fault-based system, and if the claimant is, in fact, incurred injury while performing assigned duty, then the next question is, what is the extent of the injury? Notwithstanding the fact that this occurred over a year and a half ago, at this point, we simply don't know the extent of the injury. Mr. Hanratty has actually corresponded with Mr. Vandeventer's treating physician and, in essence, written the same letter that I would have written. Unfortunately, we haven't received an answer to that letter yet. In addition, as I pointed out in my summary, Mr. Hanratty has spoken about issues of wage loss and that sort of thing. And just to make sure that the subcommittee is aware, my report is that we simply don't have the information at this point to make a recommendation on that. So, in essence, because this claim has come before us at this point, I'm going to recommend that the matter be brought forward until we can get that information.
Mr. Hartnett, how did he come to be injured by someone who didn't like him with a 2x4?
Madam Chair, I wish I knew. Unfortunately, the individual involved has been charged criminally in Chisago County, and has that trial hasn't occurred yet, so I've simply no way of knowing what the evidence are related to that. I know that we have had our Office of Special Investigations working with the Chisago County authorities, it would be inappropriate for me to make any comment about that at this point because of the pending criminal matter.
And how does the claimant, how is the claimant now able to live with his mother?
At this point, Madam Chair, the last information I had, I've got no reason to believe that he's not living with his mother, but that he was living with his companion, his son, the last I had heard. But
yeah, and he moved home with his mom. Right. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no problem.
Mr. Hanratty.
I apologize.
That's all right.
Lack of protocol. He went home. He moved home.
Did he get? So he's no longer incarcerated, and he's fulfilled his term.
Yes,
Madam Chair, I can speak to that.
Please.
When an individual has a very significant medical issue that can't be dealt with in our facility, and that's a limited case because we handle a lot of fairly serious medical cases. And as happened with Mr. Vandevender, he was granted what's called conditional medical release, which means he was released to the community to for him to pursue rehabilitative care. He initially was taken to the Regents Hospital and from there was moved to Bethesda Rehab Hospital. And after a period of time then entered a rehabilitation unit in St. Cloud. And over the course of this period of time since the injury, he has gradually worked his way into living, not living on his own, living with his mother apparently at this point. But, he went through rehabilitation. All those medical bills were, in my understanding, paid for by the department. I don't know about, there may be medical expenses related to his post. To add to that, Mr. Vandevender's Minnesota sentence expired shortly after he was released as well.
So the recommendation is to defer until a later time.
I do appreciate that this is a fantastic process, and I think that the Davis case, why would anyone would not embrace this committee in this process when you have minimizes the risk to the claimant because you know that you're fair and you'll consider this seriously based on the amount of damages that I'll present. That's all we ask. And I would ask that, Representative Johnson, I think you've been around a long time, and sometimes people get cynical about it because you think, somebody's coming to try to do something here, and it's not. It's really what it is. And there's a video out there. I want that on the record that there is a video, and I believe you've got a copy.
I don't personally have one.
Do you think we can obtain one?
That I would need to find out. Excuse me for table.
That's okay. Yeah. Representative Johnson.
I'll make the motion that we defer this.
All right. Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you for the courtesy.
Off the record, Attorney Hanratty. Do you advertise?
No, I do not.
Thank you.
I do not. I never do that. I think that's an old school kind of lawyer. I don't do that.
That's what I was thinking, but I wanted to make sure.
Yeah, I don't. I think that's.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, anyone else?
Thank you. Very much.
Thanks so, Madam Chair.
I think we got.
We can go
so
back
we'll
to
go
Carlos Castillo.
Go, we're going back to number one of DOC. Welcome. Ms. Timmons.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. The personal injury case of Carlos Castillo has an injury date of April 20th of 2013, and it was an injury in the kitchen at the Lino Lakes facility. And the claimant was draining boiling water and spilled the water on his left foot, receiving second-degree burns. So he did receive treatment right away and healed well. So the department recommends denial of this claim on the grounds that there's no permanent injury, and I am in agreement with that recommendation.
Any further discussion? Mr. Hartnett?
Madam Chair, I'll defer to Ms. Lynn, who is the claims officer that handled the number of these.
Ms. Lynn?
Madam Chairman, I have nothing else to add.
Madam Chair, motion to deny.
Senator Osmick. Thank you. Moves to deny. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Number three. No, number two.
I think we took two in the book and three on the agenda, I believe.
We're flexible. Michael Goodwin.
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this is the claim of Michael Goodwin, and it's got an yes, it's very long. It's about 225 pages long, lots of medical records.
Yeah.
It's a date of injury of June 6th of 2012. The claimant was at Stillwater doing some painting, and another offender was using some sort of a lift, forklift-type device, and brought it down on top of claimant's back. And then mostly what the paperwork in here is a lot of medical records. There were two x-rays that were taken that were negative. Two MRIs showed slight problems, but nothing requiring surgery. He had three steroid injections in his back. There was a consult with a spine specialist who said there were no objective findings and did not recommend surgery. And then shortly before the claims meeting here, Ms. Lind asked Dr. Paulson, who's one of the DOC physicians, or works with the DOC, to look at all these records and summarize the findings. And he essentially said, well, there just aren't any objective findings here, although we do have an individual who has suffered chronic pain. And Dr. Paulson recommended that claimant Goodwin go to a pain clinic. I should also let you know that we notified Samantha Goodwin, the wife of the claimant, the claim staff did, and Mrs. Goodwin wanted you all to know that her husband has now received a positive ANA test, which is an anti-nuclear antibodies test, which I know Ms. Lind has more information on this, but my understanding is that that's really a test for whether or not you have some sort of an autoimmune disease, and so which would not be caused by a traumatic injury. But Mrs. Goodwin was very concerned that you know about that. And I think one of the threads through the claim is really a claim by the claimant that there's not been enough or sufficient medical treatment on this case, which isn't really what's before the claims committee. I mean, what's before you is there a permanent injury here? And there just doesn't seem to be sufficient medical evidence of a permanent injury. And so my recommendation is for a denial. Ms. Lind may have additional information.
Ms. Lind?
Madam Chairman, members, the recommendation from Dr. Paulson was that he
he may have chronic pain syndrome, and we could definitely send him out to a chronic pain clinic. If the subcommittee had wanted us to do that, we could not just deny it, but if you could recommend him be seen by an outside clinic for that, if that's what you would determine, we could work on that part of it, not just denying it, closing it.
And then would you notify us of the progress of that then, if we did that?
Could.
Or
I certainly could. And
does there have to be proof that the chronic pain is the result of the forklift injury?
Madam Chair, I believe we would probably make, if we were to be making a recommendation to any sort of medical provider to provide what we would what's called palliative care to treat symptoms, if not necessarily treating the underlying thing. We would make sure that that doctor was aware that this was what the claim was. And very often when I've written letters to medical providers, I've provided them with summaries of the prior medical information. At some point, we may ask that doctor to issue an opinion as to what the prognosis is and that sort of thing, but that would certainly be... medical care includes not only that care that goes to try and heal the individual, but also to deal with symptoms as well.
Right. Discussion?
I have a question.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. If we were to send fund him going to a clinic, does not that indicate that maybe we shouldn't have denied the claim? If we're admitting that he has pain and it's our responsibility to fund a pain clinic for him, doesn't that sort of say that the state has determined that he deserves that on the state?
Mr. Hartnett.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi. The claims subcommittee has traditionally used Chapter 5223, which, as you're aware, is the workers' comp disability schedule. The workers' comp disability schedule has a number of sections in it which don't say that this individual doesn't have an injury. What they say is the injury, as it is presented in the objective findings, has a 0% rating. Okay. As to the whether or not there's liability, as I mentioned when Mr. Vandeventer's claim was before us, that this has not been a process that it was a fault-based process. In essence, if he is having those symptoms and they were incurred as part of his work, then that would, making pain for the palliative care appropriate, I think, under the statute.
Oh, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I know I've looked through this particular case and all the medical records quite heavily, because I'm probably one of the, probably the only one here that's part of the titanium club with a piece of titanium in my neck. Dealing with the pain from an injury, and been through the MRIs more than once, done the cortisone injections. If the MRIs does not show a problem with the in the spinal area which caused the pain, more than likely the injury did not cause that pain, because it's the technology that they have does show that up.
What's your desire?
What is the claim?
TBD.
Mr. Hardin, what was the claim?
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to defer to Ms. Lind.
I didn't
work on this claim here, so.
I'm looking for his claim form right now. $500,000.
Madam Chair, motion to deny the claim.
Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The claim is denied. Do you need the claims committee to say it's okay to go for pain relief, or can you do that by yourselves?
Is this guy still inside?
Correct.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, the department provides whatever medical care within our means to offenders that they need. So if he, in fact, needs a pain clinic, that would be provided the same as if he were to go to the dentist or to come in and have the MRI in the first place.
And the same as if he hadn't filed a claim for $500,000. All right. Go forth, then. The next item is David Huff.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, the claim of David Huff has a September 3rd, 2011 injury date. It's a sentence to service case in Waseca County, and Mr. Huff was lifting a door off a trailer and felt a pop in his back. Ultimately, there was a series of treatment. Ultimately, MRI showed disc protrusions, and there were actually two surgeries required for this gentleman, one January 24th of 2013 and one on July 2nd of 2013. I believe this is Mr. Hartnett's case, and he has recommended a 16% permanency rating for Mr. Huff, which translates into a $14,400 permanent disability payment to Mr. Huff. As I understand it, there was insurance coverage for the first surgery, so there was $5,000 not covered by Mr. Huff's insurance that's recommended to be reimbursed to Mr. Huff, together with $286.22 of out-of-pocket costs, which adds up to a total of $19,686.22. Then, in the earlier recommendation, there was a total of $2,918.81 to providers, and I, too, was just handed this additional information. I know that Mr. Hartnett was working on getting the bills from the Mayo Clinic for the second surgery, and by this time, Mr. Huff no longer had insurance, so we'd be paying that at the medical assistance rate, which looks like, if I'm seeing the bold figure here, $15,716.96, which would be added. Is that correct? Added to the 2918?
Madam Chair, Ms. Timmons, unfortunately, the Mayo Clinic provided us with the itemized bills for this July surgery, and they had the codes on them. They previous to that, they hadn't provided us with what are called the HCPCS codes, and those are the codes that the Department of Human Services uses to determine what's payable under medical assistance. So this July surgery, uninsured, the first figures on the second page of my supplemental report dated today lists nine bills. Those bills were billed at $21,556.19, and the medical assistance payable on that is $2,019.95. The folks from the Department of Human Services reviewed the bill for the hospitalization that went along with this surgery, and as you can see from the figure that Ms. Timmons reported, that was billed at $15,716.96. Unfortunately, they had miscoded it, and it was none of it was payable because of the miscoding on the bill. So I returned that bill to Mayo Clinic on the 21st and expected them to return a corrected bill to me. And when we didn't hear from them until this morning, I called and they said, well, we never got your fax. Our fax audit strip said, yes, in fact, the fax was delivered. So where it happened, as the person I spoke with this afternoon said, well, if there are 30,000 employees, sometimes things happen. So we have that bill of $15,716.96 to pay for the hospitalization on his second surgery, and I simply have no way of letting you know what the medical assistance payable on that is. So the 2019-95 I would recommend be added to my February recommendations. And if the subcommittee will grant their indulgence, one thing I could do would be, I'm hoping that I'll know about this before Wednesday, and I could let Ms. Timmons know what the medical assistance payable is on that. My experience tells me that for a $15,000 bill, it will be between $5,000 and $7,000. Now, that doesn't mean I won't be fooled because I tell you, I have this stuff is Greek to me. But generally, as you can see, it was paid out at 10 cents on the dollar for a number of the services. But 30 cents on the dollar is fairly common for hospitalization. Again, that's just my layman's guess. We have made a recommendation on a number of things in this claim. This is actually, while Mr. Huff did have a serious back injury, we've certainly had much more severe injuries in these past 20 years. But this is perhaps the most complex claim I've had to deal with. Part of the problem was that Mr. Huff was insured for most of his medical care. That insurance didn't cover all of his expenses. He had co-pays, deductibles, et cetera. It's been the subcommittee's practice to reimburse claimants for that because that you don't want somebody who has insurance to be in a worse position than someone who doesn't have insurance. So my recommendation in the February thing was to reimburse Mr. Huff for his out-of-pocket expenses and also to pay him $5,000, which is the amount left over after insurance from his first surgery in 2013 that was sent to collections by the Mayo Clinic. Another thing that made this claim very complicated is that Mr. Huff submitted bills for a number of things that weren't really related to his injury, his cable bill, his unemployment compensation, a number of medical bills that he incurred during this period of time or that his children incurred, but which weren't related to this injury. And I would certainly recommend that those be denied. The last and probably, he also submitted a claim for parking, which I think is reasonable because he had receipts from the parking at the Mayo Clinic. But he also submitted a claim for his fuel to get to Rochester, but simply, rather than giving me a mileage thing, simply gave me a mitt full of gas receipts. So I had no way of knowing how much of that gasoline was used. So if he is able to provide us with a mileage, I would probably recommend that. Obviously, that's not something that the claims subcommittee has paid very frequently in the past, mileage and those other kinds of expenses. But perhaps the biggest thing is that Mr. Huff submitted a letter from his employer, which indicated that he made, he was a pipeline inspector. And between his wages and overtime, had a significant, potential for income during that period of time or a significant income. Unfortunately, the letter from his employer didn't let me know if he would have been paid this amount, if he had been paid this amount, if he had been paid part of this amount, etc. But if you'll review the February figures, the total for the 2 years was listed at $176,000. There may very well be a valid wage claim in this case, but without knowing what the medical restrictions were with some specificity and knowing what his wage was with some specificity and whether or not they had work available during that period of time, that we wouldn't be able to offer the subcommittee any kind of recommendation. So that matter plus the travel, if the subcommittee so chooses, I would recommend that you hold in abeyance.
Questions? Discussion?
I have a question, Ms. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
So we're to, I mean, thank you, Ms. Chair. So he's working in, he's in sentence to serve. So he's, his wages weren't applicable at that time as well. So was this to be applied, was this wages that he would have earned after he was done with his sentence to serve sentence?
Madam Chair, Senator Scalzi, that correct. That's another thing that's unknown to me. I don't know exactly. He was on the sentence to serve crew out of the local jail, the Ladena County Jail, serving a sentence for something. I don't know exactly how long he was in the Ladena County Jail and to what extent the fact he was incarcerated affected his wages. Additionally, as I mentioned before, he submitted a bill for unemployment compensation arrearage, which suggests to me that he was drawing on unemployment compensation during that period of time, which again suggests that he probably had an economic layoff during that period of time, and I don't think that that would be reasonably attachable to his injury.
Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, so I think the bottom line is that we have before us, before the subcommittee, a payment of $19,686.22 to Mr. Huff. And if I added up the $2,918.81 and the $2,019.95 together correctly, I come up with a new total to medical providers of $4,938.76. And then I guess the issue, the only other issue, is whether the subcommittee wants to authorize me to add the, if Mr. Hartnett can very soon get the medical assistance rate for that second Mayo surgery, if you would like to authorize me to add that to your, the author's amendment that I'll be preparing for you, Madam Chair, and Co-Chair Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Timmons, that's correct. I checked the fax machine about a dozen times this afternoon, and I think probably the other thing about 30,000 employees is they don't quite necessarily work in a single day. So I'm certainly trying to disparage one of our finest medical institutions in the world, but
not in this biennium. So do we want to do this? Senator?
Yes,
I think we should. Senator Carlson moves the amounts that Ms. Timmons read off and will hear soon.
Madam Chair, one other thing, since we're going to be writing some legislation here, I have to apologize to the subcommittee. Mr. Huff's last name is spelled H-U-F-F, not H-O-F-F. And I wrote H-O-F-F on my...
It's like show. Huff and Puff. Huff.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And this is contingent on getting some new numbers.
Correct.
Before the bill is read.
Senator Carlson, that's correct. I anticipated that when I talked to Mayo today and they told me, well, they must have lost your fax. I don't know that they must not have received our fax. I suspect they received it and it simply didn't get to the right place. I did tell them that if we could get the numbers before tonight, I could possibly avoid this being that part of it being held over for an additional year. If the subcommittee's indulgence for us to give those numbers to Ms. Timmons, I would expect to have them before, I think Thursday is when this matter goes before yes. judicial.
Yeah. All in favor of the Carlson motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Next item is Michael Livingston.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Michael Livingston is another sentenced to service case, this time in Meeker County, a date of entry of October 25th of 2011. And the crew this time was changing a sleeve on a dust collector, which I had to Google, but it looked like sort of a machine that was collecting dust. And they were in changing a sleeve. A lot of dust came out, and Mr. Livingston breathed in the dust and had to be taken to the hospital, and it was actually pretty serious. He had to be intubated in order to be able to breathe, but they were able to successfully extubate him, and fortunately there is no permanent injury. But the department is recommending the payment of $5,608.02 to medical providers, and I am in agreement with that.
Further discussion?
Madam Chair, motion to approve payment of medical expenses to the tune of $5,608.02.
All in favor of the OSMIC motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Scalzi.
Before we move on, I just wanted to let you know that Representative Simon just contacted me, and they're soon to have a second child, and his wife's not feeling well tonight. So he asked if he was needed for votes, and I said we have two of each body, just so you know. So,
thank you. Yes, that baby is due before next week at yes. this time. So maybe tonight's the night. Or maybe not.
Roll call on that.
I don't think he'd appreciate that. Number six on the agenda is David Morrow.
Yes.
Another one that's being recommended for pay.
Yes, Madam Chair. And members, I think we have another first name issue here. Some of the documentation says David and some of it says Donald. I think it's Donald is the correct first name. But in any event, this is
Mr. Morrow.
Yes, it's Mr. Morrow. And he was injured, STS again, in Hennepin County. And it was a wood splitter injury where his right hand was caught between the cutting blade and the hydraulic ram, and that was going into the wood splitter. So he had a crush injury and partial amputation of the third, fourth, and fifth digits on the right hand. The department recommends payment of $5,509.28 to medical providers. And then on permanency, there are actually two different departmental recommendations in here. And in all fairness, I should let you know that the first recommendation was not to pay permanency. Ms. Lind, and I know she can tell you about the phone call she made, but she apparently had a conversation with Mr. Morrow, who said he did not have a permanent disability, although he did say that in the original claim that he might.
And then I actually asked the department to take a second look at this and either get medical information or simply take a second look, simply because having either been the claims counsel for a couple of years and observed Mr. Lindeke for a number of years, if there's a partial amputation of three fingertips, that usually has resulted in a permanency rating. So now the department did take a second look and wrote an updated recommendation that included a fairly small rating, but a 4.4% permanency rating, which translates to $3,300 for permanency. And I guess I would recommend that in the interest, I think, of consistency with other cases and the no-fault approach that the claims committee takes. Perhaps the department has other information.
Ms. Lynn.
Chairman and members. He did not ask for a partial disability payment. He just wanted his medical bills to be paid. And Michelle Timmons is correct. We did take a second look at it and determined that he did have a permanent disability, even though he did not ask for payment for that.
Madam Chair, if I might expand on that a little bit. And this is a number of years of experience in working in the workers' comp field. Amputations of the finger are not rateable if they're less than a centimeter from the end of the finger. In other words, if you lop off, excuse my using Germanic terms here, that if you take off the tip of the finger essentially to where the bone starts, it's not something that is considered a disability that can be rateable. In reviewing the surgical report, and giving the rating, or giving, excuse me, the objective findings that the surgeon reported, and giving the benefit of the doubt to the applicant, it appeared that these amputations were beyond that single centimeter mark. So that gives you the lowest rating for that particular digit, and that's the reason that the permanency. Applying the multiple injury factor, that's the reason the permanency is where it is.
And so that's the $3,300.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Did they save them? Did they save the tips?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that was even a consideration. I don't think that was something that. I wish I could tell you that the valiant efforts that our staff and sometimes even some of our offenders or other crew members do to try and make sure that this digit that's removed stays viable. I've seen very few of them where the digit has been able to be put back on.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scalzi.
I would move approval of 5509.28. to medical providers and $3,300 to the claimant. Mr. Morrow.
Is there any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Moving right along to Mr. Missunas?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. Stanley Missunas. This is date of injury, January 17th, 2013. It was a slip and fall at the Faribault facility when Mr. Missunas was on his way to work at the laundry. He was treated. He hit his head. He was treated. But there's fortunately no permanency, and therefore the department recommends denial, and I'm in agreement with that.
Madam Chair.
Representative? Senator? Oh, I'm so sorry. Senator Osmek.
Motion to deny per staff recommendation.
All in favor of the OSMIC motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Jamie Patton. Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Jamie Patton. This is an injury in prison at Faribault, April 9th, 2012. It happened in the cabinet-making shop. It's another right-hand injury caught on a saw. Sounds like this one was significantly more serious than Mr. Marl's that we just discussed. Three fingertips amputated plus nerve damage in one finger. And so with the ratings combined, it translates to a 13.1% rating, a dollar award of $11,135. That's the department recommendation, and I'm in agreement with that.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Based upon the recommendations of the council, I would recommend the payment to the claimant of $11,135.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Becca Ratzlaff.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. This is another STS injury in Hennepin County. And Ms. Ratzlaff was on January 9th of 2012. She was hauling a large branch over some railroad tracks and then twisted her right foot in the gravel that was in between the tracks and the wood there on the train track. And she had a fairly serious foot injury. I learned a new term, a Lisfranc injury, which Ms. Lind also researched and gave you a lot of information about it. So Ms. Ratzlaff did need two surgeries, but it does not appear that there's any permanency. The medical records simply indicated that she ended her treatment. And then I believe Ms. Lind also contacted Ms. Ratzlaff, who said she did not have a permanent injury at this time. So the recommendation here is to pay Ms. Ratzlaff $513.97 for some out-of-pocket medical costs that were for prescriptions and so forth. And then because she did have two surgeries, the payment to medical providers adds up to $15,125.33.
And what about that part where they're supposed to maybe hold over?
Madam Chair, I can elaborate.
Ms. Lind?
We were waiting for a doctor's note to come in to indicate that she did not have a permanent injury. And we have not been able to obtain that. So I did call and talk to her several days ago, and I let her know that we were waiting on that. And she, again, indicated, I don't have a permanent injury. It's just sore once in a while. So if you would like to hold it over until I can get that documentation from the doctor, we could do that, or we could just pay the provider that indicated.
The $15,000 and the $513.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Osmek. Senator Osmek. Senator.
No sense in waiting around. If she says she doesn't want it, it's time to move on. Motion to pay medical provider expenses of $15,125.33 and pay to the claimant $513.59 for additional medical treatment.
So. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Russell Damon.
Right. Madam Chair and members, this is one where we had trouble deciding which was the last name and which was the first name. We think it's Damon Russell, and Russell is the last name. But in any event, so I think it's Mr. Russell as opposed to Mr. Damon. He had an injury November 1st of 2012. It was another wood splitter injury. Right pointer finger was caught between a piece of wood and the splitter. It was an STS case in Olmsted County. He needed 6 stitches and nail bed repair, but had a good result and no permanency. So the recommendation on this one from the department, with which I concur, is to pay medical providers $1,840.35.
Ms. Chair. Senator Scalzi.
Based upon the recommendation of counsel, I would move to pay $1,840.35 to the medical providers in the case of Damon Russell or Russell Damon, whichever is correct.
Further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Brian Troutman.
Madam Chair and members, I believe this is the last injury claim. Brian Troutman is another STS injury, this time in Winona County. He was shoveling snow on March 11th of 2013 by the Winona County Courthouse when a large block of snow fell off the courthouse roof and fell on him. So there was need for medical treatment, but fortunately no permanent injury. So the recommendation here is a payment of $1,789.11 to medical providers.
Senator Osmick.
Madam Chair, motion to pay medical claims totaling $1,789.11 for medical assistance payments.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Let's go back to number one.
It's in the second book.
On the first sheet.
It was a MnDOT project.
Claims against Department of
Prevailing Wage.
Transportation.
So we're going to take
Prevailing Wage. John Ward. Mr. Corey Zian. Claim by Corey Zian.
This is a MnDOT. It's working for MnDOT. Paid prevailing wage, and now the contractor's back in Texas. They can't get anyone.
Say no.
Other than the whole. Yeah.
No.
So he's the only one who's made a claim, but there's other workers that were aware. Maybe you want to go through this again. Yeah. I'm kind of going back and forth, but maybe you want to give us an overview.
Chair and members, would you like me to try to summarize this one very briefly?
Yes.
This is a claim in which MnDOT did an audit and of a project for renovation in Staples, Minnesota, and discovered that 8 individuals had not been paid prevailing wage on this particular job. And the people who were underpaid did not file against the payment bond. And I think part of the reason for that is because they didn't get notice about that until the audit that was done quite some time later. And so this claimant, Corey Zion, is actually owed $5,769.80 from this MG Carlson company. But MnDOT has made many, many attempts to get the contractor to pay
contractor has fled the state, is apparently in Texas, can't be served with any papers. So Mr. Zion brought this claim asking that he be paid for the underpayment of his work out of the amount MnDOT retained as the contract retainage. Now, and there was quite a bit of testimony at the beginning of the claims committee meeting, and apparently the other seven people who were underpaid did not make claims. Only Mr. Zion has made a claim. The Department of Transportation does recommend denying the claim, really for policy reasons, stating, and there's a letter that speaks for itself, but really says, look, there is a statutory scheme for resolving these things. It's the payment bond that runs to the benefit of the people who get paid by this project. And so Mr. Zion and the others really need to go after M.G. Carlson, not after MnDOT. But there is some retainage, and we did resolve that it's not the 19-some thousand in Commissioner Zell's letter. It's the $10,961.02 that is in a proposed settlement agreement with the performance bondholder that's in your materials. So, you know, I guess the options are deny the claim, or if the other option is to pay the claim out of the retainage. And what I drafted up, because this is pretty complicated, I prepared some draft language that says pay each of these eight individuals pro rata according to how much they were underpaid. That's essentially what the draft amendment says that I prepared. Madam Chair, you asked about how much Mr. Zion would be owed, and that's that $5,769.80 figure. This language could certainly be easily changed to put that figure in on lines 1.4 and 1.12 to pay Mr. Zion the full amount of his claim. And then for the others who haven't claimed, that 66 some figure on 1.17 would be reduced, if my math is correct, to $5,191.22. So that would be another option. So there's sort of two viable options here: deny the claim, or pay the authorize the Department of Transportation to pay the claim out of the contract retainage. And then if you decide to do that, then there's a subset issue as to whether you want to pay all of them pro rata or pay the full amount to Mr. Zion and pro rata to the others who did not submit a claim, if that makes any sense. That's, I think.
And I would move, Madam Chair, that we for the first set of motions, just to pay the claim out of the retainage that was kept from the Carlson Company. That would be the first motion.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And then the second motion...
opposed. No.
And then my second motion would... I'm sorry, Ms. Chair. Did you want me to proceed?
No, but there has to be two votes from both sides.
Oh, okay.
Go on.
So we have
two votes from each house.
Do we have two votes from each side?
No. I didn't hear. I just heard one from this side.
This side?
From this side.
Both from your side.
Representative Simon is not here, so you don't have two votes.
Okay.
I can speak to it a little bit if you'd like.
Representative Senator Carlson.
Well, I checked into this with MnDOT, and they had a lot of problems with this vendor. They did get the work done, so there isn't anything that is remaining to be done, but retainage is something that you do retain so that everything is done. In this particular case, the contractor shorted his employer, or his employee. Now, I think there was a problem of not meeting the deadline in filing this, if I remember correctly. So there's mitigating circumstances. But if we deny it, then MnDOT gets that 10%. I think it's 10% withholding.
It's $10,000.
I think, I don't remember how much the...
I don't know either.
I think it was a 10% withholding. So MnDOT gets to keep that, and the people who did the work don't get paid. So that's why I would move the... I would support the pro rata distribution of the money.
Senator Osmond.
While I appreciate those comments, the problem is this opens up Pandora's box, in my opinion, is that, you know, the reserve is designed to make sure that he performs the terms of his contract. He performed the terms of his contract. Granted, we will be capturing that money, but if we start, as the state of Minnesota, to start using and capturing and holding because we see an employment issue that is a private contract between the employer and the employee, we begin to slide down a slippery slope, a very difficult one to stop, because now we have on the record that the state of Minnesota says if you don't pay prevailing wage or if you don't live up to the terms of your subcontract with your employee, now we're going to begin taking that money, which is not, in my opinion, not legal, because the retainage was for a specific purpose. Did you lay the correct depth of asphalt? Did you lay the correct curbage? Did you perform to the terms that you agreed? And if the answer is yes, then that's where the contract between the state and that contractor ends. I sympathize with the individual that he can't chase down this person to get what he is owed, but that's what civil courts are for.
Madam Chair, I would
Senator Carlson.
I guess I would ask if paying prevailing wage is part of the contract, because then he didn't perform his contract. Prevailing wage is required in the contract, then
he didn't perform his
contract. Madam Chair. I agree with you, Senator. Representative Johnson.
I'm torn on this issue, but I also look at the employees did not know that they were short of their wages by the way they were calculated. It wasn't until after the audit was done that they were notified, and that was well after the time period that they could actually have filed against the insurance bond. So the employees had nowhere they could go. All they could do is the state could try to force the hold the retainer bond from the contractor until he paid that. The contractor left town, just not after his money. So it's an issue where the employees, even though the contractor moved out of state, they have to go after the contractor for that.
And I thought that Mr. Zan did know, and he was working with DOT beforehand.
He was working with DOT, but if I believe Representative Ward stated that, and the Department of Transportation, it's 120 days from the completion of the project. The project was completed 1 year. The audit was another year. So it's more than 120 days.
But I thought Mr. Zeeland had contacted DOT before the audit.
My understanding it was the DOT had contacted them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Osmond.
Question for legal counsel. I want to go to what the chair indicated. Was there a contractual obligation in writing between the state of Minnesota and the company that they had to perform to prevailing wages, and is that set on the same par as a performance with other terms of the contract?
Madam Chair, Senator Osmak, I do not believe the actual contract is in the documentation that you have or that I was given. So I can't answer that question with 100% certainty, but I believe it is very typical to put the requirement to pay prevailing wage into MnDOT contracts. So I believe it was in there, but I have not seen the actual contract.
It does say the first sentence in the second paragraph of the March 7th letter says that MnDOT put significant effort and resources into ensuring that MnDOT's contractors comply with prevailing wage law. So evidently
it is in law, and that makes it a requirement.
Madam Chair, I would suggest that I could only vote yes if I saw that it was part of the contract that was signed that clearly stated to that that contractor that they did have to provide it. That would make a difference in my vote. I think I would agree with you if they agreed contractually, specifically, explicitly in the contract, not just a gee whiz, we want you to pay prevailing wages. I think I would have a different opinion.
I think it is in the law, but I don't have a contract.
Madam Chair.
The contract. Representative Johnson.
The other issue with the testifiers was talking during the audit. It was just the difference was in how the employee was classified, whether it was a roofer or if they're doing carpentry work. It's different pay scale for those individuals depending on what they're doing, which actually makes payroll very difficult to do. So you have to keep track of the time of what you're doing at each part of the job.
That's true. Ms. Timmons.
Madam Chair and members, Senator Osmak, I do see in this January 20th, 2011 letter to Marty Carlson, the demand letter, that's page 13 of 32 in that documentation. The last paragraph says, as the prime contractor, you are legally required to ensure compliance with the contract labor provisions and the contractual requests of the department. So I do believe that the prevailing wage requirement was in the contract. Yeah. Okay, and thank you, Ms. Henry Wangenstein has also showed me the letter, November 15th, 2013 letter, which went to the performance bond carrier. And that states several employees were not paid prevailing wages as required by both statute and the contract. So it was in the contract.
That's enough for me.
I don't have a strong opinion about the others, but I think that Mr. Zan should have his claim acknowledged.
Madam Chair,
Senator Osmak.
In light of the additional information, I do agree that there could be some stickiness and I wasn't here for some of the testimony. I'll stipulate that it probably would have had some other difficulties. I'll move to approve this claim. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Correction. I will move the language in the handout A14. But you still don't have two on both sides. It doesn't matter what I say.
Great. I should call Steve Simon and tell him to run down here and see what he thinks. We could be here all night.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
Close enough.
The motion does not prevail.
Wait, he said yes. He said yes this time.
I said yes.
My oratory explanation got him.
It was very quiet. I'm sorry. I was so quiet. No, you didn't say no. Oh, okay. Very good. Very good.
Hey, I did it.
Thank you. Very, very good, Senator.
Matt.
Why?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd also make motion that all 8 employees get divided up, prorated evenly. Otherwise, you might have this situation when get to the 8th one that makes a claim, there'd be no money left.
And that's what this says.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's how the A14 amendment is drafted, because it gives Mr. Zion the $4,284.92, which was the pro rata. And then paragraph B allows the department to pay the other 7 individuals pro rata according to how much they were underpaid.
Yeah, that I'm aware of that, but there was talk about doing the one getting the full amount and
I gave on that.
Bipartisanship.
I gave on that. So 4,000 is better than nothing. Whatever it is, 4,000 something. No.
Oh, what about the second page?
The second page?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think we've got a few other things.
We have one more vote on hold.
Yeah, we have the story, Greg and Lisa's story vote on hold, the approval of the minutes, and then we have the second page with the DOC property claims.
Right. Yeah. I didn't want to. I wanted to get these out of the way in case anyone would think of walking out early. So, number 4 on the agenda, this Lisa and Greg story, and that was to be held over, right?
No,
we didn't have a quorum.
Didn't have a quorum.
Right, but
Madam
the recommendation
Chair and
was.
Members. If you'd like me to summarize just briefly.
Please, because my memory is...
Yeah,
vague.
These are the 2 property taxpayers who
did not
file their property tax refund by the deadline and wrote a letter saying they just didn't know about it and it wasn't clear enough on the form. And they did not appear this evening. And there was no indication of any hardship that prevented them from filing the claim, the refund claim, in a timely manner. So that was essentially the testimony.
So, Ms. Chair.
Senator Scalzi.
I will move to deny the claim for Lisa and Greg's story of $653 because of no hardship known other than they missed the deadline.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. The claim is denied. And then there's the minutes from April 16th. So move that memorable evening. Representative Johnson moves adoption of minutes as printed. Any changes? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Approved. Okay. So now we've completed everything on the first page. And now we're on to property claims and a whole new book. It's a skinnier book. Are any of these recommended to pass?
Madam Chair and members, these are the property claims.
These are tennis shoes and stuff like that.
Yep, these are the tennis shoes and TVs. And there are 40
41 on your list, plus one request for rehearing. And there's one more that was on the papers on your desk, a Christopher Belosky.
Yep.
And so that one should be added to the top batch, the property claims. And there were just three of these that I thought might merit some discussion, and they're on your agenda in kind of a pink, I guess. Number 7, David Caroon, 24, Albert Lucas, and 27, Devin Nealon.
Does that include, is Christopher Belosky a pink too?
That is, no, that would be a black one.
And Marvin Spencer isn't pink either.
Nope, he's not pink either.
Okay, let's do the pinks.
Okay.
I do not have the Christopher Blotch here.
Oh.
Is that a DLC coin?
It was handed out tonight.
Belosky.
It was one. Yeah, I have it for you. It was one you sent to us asking where it was, I think.
Yeah. Did we do this?
So. Yes. So the first pink one is David Caroon, which is number 7, and I believe it's marked with a red tab in your book. This is one in which the claimant claimed quite a list of property, $323.75 worth that he said went missing. And the department was able to account for most of it, but the department could not find a TENS unit battery and charger. And the department did offer Mr. Caroon the $76.05 for compensation for that. He rejected that and instead tried to go to conciliation court, where I think there was a much longer list of property and a higher dollar amount. And that was dismissed in conciliation court largely on statutory grounds that there's, in the tort claim statute, there's an exclusion for property claims from inmates of institutions. And so many times when Mr. Lindeke was doing this, if the department had offered to pay at one time in good faith, Mr. Lindeke would recommend reoffering the amount. And so I pulled it out to see if you would wish to direct the department to reoffer that $76.05 or wish to deny the claim.
Why would we do the $76.05?
Because it was an amount that the department offered as compensation for property that they agreed was lost or misplaced. And many times in the past, claims committees have asked the department to reoffer the amount. That would be the only reason. I don't know if Ms. Lind has other information.
Madam Chairman,
Ms. Lind.
Madam Chair.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Motion to deny the entire claim. I'm not willing to. If he doesn't want it, he's not getting it. He's not going to get it from me. I'm a tough jailer.
What's that called?
Tough
love?
Yes.
I don't know if there's any love here.
He had his chance, right?
Yep.
And he didn't take it?
Yep.
Yep.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Okay, man.
No Judge Judy school here.
Okay. 8:30 at night. No.
24, Lucas.
Yes, Madam Chair and members. 24 is Albert Lucas. This is an offender who was at Faribault, and he was found with contraband, in particular cell phones, which do not perhaps on their surface seem dangerous, but can be very dangerous in a facility because they can be used to all gang members or any number of nefarious things. In any event, on page 12 of 17 of that documentation, the narrative says from the staff, on 4/24/12, I inventoried Lucas's property because he was sent back to MCF Faribault. He had several items that were not on his property list and that are contraband. He had two extra pair of New Balance shoes, two extra headphones, both damaged, two extra earbuds, and some other things. It's really the two extra pair, the two pair of New Balance shoes that are at issue, because if you flip back a page on 10 of 17, you can see that he did have two pair of New Balance shoes. One was received on January 12th of 2012, the other on April 18th of 2012, before this incident of April 24th. And the offender supplied quite a bit of documentation about the exact prices of the shoes and the fact that they were medically authorized special New Balance shoes. And so what the department has recommended denial, saying, well, he's in essence had four pairs of shoes. Two pairs were over the limit, and it's too bad if the ones that were over the limit and seized as over the limit were the special ones that he had ordered and were medically authorized. In the past, the subcommittee has been concerned about medically authorized items, and so I thought you might want to look at this.
Yes, Lynn.
Madam Chairman and members, I think the main point here is the entire time the offender was in segregation, I think it was 45 days, he did not request a pair of medically authorized New Balance shoes. And so the claims officer at the facility maintained that if he needed the shoes so bad, why didn't he ask for them while he was in segregation for the 45 days?
Maybe in segregation he didn't need to run.
Madam Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Since this gentleman looks like a lengthy habit of having more items than he's allowed to have, and if he'd have turned in the two pair of shoes that he was over and begin with, he wouldn't have had that issue, so I motion for denial.
Continuing with our tough love. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Claim is denied. Two pairs of shoes. Why didn't he throw the put the ones that were most worn? Turn them over. I have a garage sale. Sale. Gosh. The next one is Neeland, Devin. 27.
Yes, Madam Chair and members, this is the last one that I thought warranted any discussion, and I will confess I pulled this one out because of something Representative Simon said last year.
But he's not here.
And he's not here. But this is a case where the claimant went to segregation on May 20th of 13, and staff packed up his property and including his television, and staff checked to see if the TV worked on May 20th of 13, and it did, which is also what the claimant said. Then when he got out of segregation on July 17th of 13, he brought the TV back to his cell, plugged it in, and it didn't work. And complained right away and reported that it didn't work. And what I was hearing in my head when I read this one is Representative Simon saying last year, well, counsel, is there anything more he could have done, and isn't there circumstantial evidence here that something must have happened to the TV while he was in segregation? I did mention that to Ms. Lind, and I understand there is a room or an opportunity at the property department where an offender can plug in his television. Perhaps you could flesh that out a little bit.
Ms. Lind.
Madam Chairman and members, when offenders pick up their property after being inside, they're given the opportunity to be placed in a holding area and thoroughly go through their property. If there are any discrepancies at that time, they're to note it on the bottom of the inventory sheet before signing it. They have the opportunity to plug in any electronics to make sure that they're working. And they do this at the facilities to discourage these types of claims exactly so that the offender doesn't go back to the cell and decide that he wants to do TV. So he's going to say that his TV was broke when he received it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Osmick.
Motion to deny this claim and all remaining property claims.
I remember when we talked about this last year. Do you remember, Senator Carlson? Remember? And Steve was... No, if it was working when they left, why isn't it working when they came back?
Capacitors go out.
That's when TVs fail.
Start shuffling around.
Atomic tubes.
Capacitors.
Capacitors.
Well, that's when TVs fail, is when you turn them on.
Yep.
They usually
don't fail.
Oh. Was it a TV last year, too?
I don't remember. This is a...
I remember, but he said that he had read all these, and he had some questions about four of them. This might have been one, but the Osmick motion is before us. Is there any, before we take it though, is there any others that when you were reading through them in preparation for this meeting that you wanted to discuss a little bit more? Is there any, Ms. Lind, is there any that you want to point out to us?
Are you talking about all of them in two? So you haven't gone through that one.
No, we haven't. But he's including it in his motion. Okay. Nothing more. All right. Then the Osmick motion is before us to deny this and all of the... property claims that we have not reviewed on tape, but we reviewed them before we got to the committee.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor of the Osmick motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is carried. Is there any other business to come before us?
Madam Chair, motion to adjourn.
Very good. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion to adjourn.
Anytime.
This meeting is adjourned.